The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now we want to look towards Qatar. From shock results in matches, protests regarding human rights issues, the current World Cup leaves much to be discussed. And I'm joined by Irish journalist Phil O'Connor, who is in Qatar. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Pat. How are you?
I'm very well. Now, talk to me about the fan experience, first of all. I mean, is the fan aware of any kind of human rights abuses or any restrictions in terms of how they go about their attendance at matches or the fan zones?
I think it's very different. The fan experience and the working experience here are probably very different, Pat. Of course, Qatar wants to put forward its best side. The city of Doha is basically the centre for this entire World Cup. All stadiums are within an hour of where I'm sitting here, and the whole city has been more or less given over to this celebration of football. But things are very, very different depending on who you are. If you're Lionel Messi, you're going to have a different experience of this World Cup to a journalist like myself or to a fan travelling from Argentina or from England. But then there are also the migrant workers who actually make up the vast majority of the population here, and they would have a very different experience indeed to that. So things are very much separated. There's a fan zone not too far from where I'm sitting here in a place called Al Bidda, which is quite central in the city, and that's sort of restricted to people who have what's called a Hayya card, which is a sort of a visa that's given out to people who have bought tickets for the World Cup. So you have to have this to be able to access those zones, and they're sort of separate from the zones where the migrant workers themselves
okay.
who would
so let's talk about that particular fan zone. I mean, if you have a ticket, say, for two of the matches, does that entitle you to go to the fan zone for all of the matches?
Yeah, exactly. So that kind of works as your visa to get into Qatar and to move around the town as you will. You know, so certain areas are restricted. You have to remember, Pat, that in the beginning, this was 32 countries and all the fans in the same city, basically. So there was the potential for it to get very, very crowded when, you know, you've maybe over 100,000 people going to a match on a public transport system in one day. So in order to control that situation where people can go and can't go, they've used this Hayya card system.
Yeah. Now, tell me about the metro, which is supposed to be a magnificent creation. Is it working well? Do people get to the matches on time? Do they get back from the matches to where they want to go efficiently?
Yeah, it's working extraordinarily well, it has to be said. The one thing that I would have said in the very beginning of the tournament, Pat, it was kind of noticeable that the people here and the security people weren't used to dealing with very, very large crowds of people. You know, so people in the police and the Garda Síochána will tell you that there's a way of moving people around the place in a safe manner so that you avoid crushes like the one that we saw, the fatal accident that happened in South Korea for a few weeks ago, for instance. So you have to be very careful in where you let people in and out. And in the beginning, it looked a little bit ragged there, but they've very much gotten a handle on that now, and they're sort of directing people. And the one thing there's no shortage of here is labor. So every 5 meters you'll see somebody standing there with a big foam rubber hand telling you what direction you're supposed to go in. The metro runs until 3 o'clock in the morning, which is working well, but you never know, with extra time and penalties now at the knockout stages, it might be a little bit tight for some of us getting home.
Yeah. Now, the ordinary fan, is that fan aware of the restrictions? I mean, we know about the LGBT plus issues. We will talk in a moment or two about the way migrant workers have been treated. But in terms of human rights and so on, do people feel in any way constrained?
I don't really think so. I don't think that that's evident to most people. The big thing for many football fans coming here from Denmark and from Germany and from England is the fact that sales of alcohol are restricted. But there's no obvious signs of that kind of thing on the street, Pat, unless you think about it. You know, every security guard that you pass is probably on the minimum wage here, which is probably not more than €300 a month. They work 12 hours a day, sometimes 6-7 days a week. So the evidence is there before your eyes. But at a big event like this, that tends to get forgotten about as people get swept up in the excitement of competition.
Now, we know that most of these big events, they are awash with alcohol. This one is not. You can get, what is it, 4 half-litres in the fan zone. That's your beer allocation. You can drink, presumably, in the bar in your hotel, but certainly far less alcohol than would be normal at these occasions. Does it make a difference?
It makes a huge difference. There's no bar in the hotel where I am, for instance. There's very few what they call wet bars. I'm in a dry hotel. I don't drink anyway, which is probably a good thing. But so it's quite difficult to get hold of. It's very, very expensive as well. There's an Irish musician, Martin Farahar, who's known as Faraway Martin, was telling me that most people would go and you pay a cover charge that might be 75 or 80 euros a cup, maybe one day a week, and you could drink as many beers as you like. Otherwise, it could be up to 15 euros for a pint glass or a half litre of beer. So under normal circumstances, as you would see beer for sale in the stadiums. The only beer there now is alcohol-free from one of the sponsors. But the flip side of that, Pat, is that it's very, very calm here. Normally, you know, like in Manchester and Liverpool, you would try not to have the two home teams playing home games on the same weekend, let alone the same day. But the lack of alcohol has led to a much better atmosphere. And indeed, for female fans, some people would have thought that coming to a Middle Eastern country where women's freedoms are restricted, there might be more difficult for them. But I've actually spoken to female fans who said the opposite is true, that they actually feel safer here and that they feel treated with much more respect. And that is in part, not in whole, but in part due to the lack of alcohol that's on sale here.
Now, in terms of the matches themselves, you've been in the stadiums. I don't know how many of the four stadiums you've actually attended. Much talk about air conditioning in one and, you know, how fit for purpose they are. To the television observer, they seem to be terrific.
It's phenomenal. I mean, this is, you know, when you can invest an endless amount of money in something, it's going to be good. So it's rumored to have cost over $200 billion, which is far in excess of any other World Cup that has ever taken place. And that's the thing in Qatar, that they just keep spending money on things. The stadiums are absolutely fantastic. The Al Bayt Stadium is basically a Bedouin tent in the desert in stadium form. It's incredible. And the architecture, I'm looking at the window here, Pat, at the National Museum in Doha, and the architecture here is phenomenal, quite simply because this is one of the wealthiest nations in the world. The air conditioning isn't a huge problem. It's basically like a beautiful summer's day here in Doha. And then in the evening, most of the kickoffs now are late in the afternoon. So they take place at 6 in the evening here and then 10 o'clock at night. So the heat isn't a problem. But that said, you can see these air vents. If you look closely when a player is taking a throw in, you'll see the air vents for air conditioning that's on during the match. And I know that a lot of the photographers you'll see behind the goal, they appreciated that when we had matches in mid-afternoon here.
Now, let's talk about the migrant workers. I mean, you're talking about migrant workers who are still there, even though the construction of the infrastructure is complete, but they're working. I mean, they have obviously cleaners. You have these people with the big foam fingers pointing the way. You've got all the services that are required for such a huge number of visitors. What will happen to them afterwards?
Well, the biggest prize at the World Cup at the moment, Pat, is work in January for these people. There are so many people who have come to Qatar from Nepal, from Bangladesh, from Kerala in India, from Uganda, from Kenya. And you see them everywhere working in security, working in cleaning, doing whatever's needed. I talked to a young man the other day from Kenya, and he had been working on the construction of two of the stadiums and was now a traffic marshal. And he's just hoping that there's going to be something for him to do. I spoke to another man from Uganda who said, look, the people who were brought here in the last 6 months of the last year, they're going to be sent home straight away, because you're dependent, your right to stay here in Qatar is dependent on you having a contract with an employer. Now, previously, your employer basically owned you. It was very difficult to change from one job to another. So if you didn't like the foreman or if you felt in any way mistreated, it was very difficult. Your only option basically was to leave Iraq. And that's the difficult situation that many people find themselves in, Pat. But we have to remember that these people come here because they're coming from a situation that they find worse. So I spoke to a man from Bangladesh the other day who tries to send around about 40 to 50 euros to his wife every month, because that's what she and his daughter need to survive in Bangladesh. And here he earns maybe 300 to 400 euros a month. So you're talking about people who are coming from extreme poverty to a situation which is not much better, but it's still better all the same in their view. And an awful lot of them do want to stay here because there's simply nowhere better for them to go.
Now, the mortality rate during the construction of the stadiums was supposed to be, well, it could be in the thousands. No one is quite sure. Do the immigrant workers themselves reflect upon that? Do they see what they were doing as dangerous work?
Yeah, I think they see it as being very dangerous work and very hard work. And it's interesting the way people speak. If you have a camera, if you ask people to speak on camera here, they don't want to speak on the record. They don't want to be seen. They don't want their photographs taken. But if you speak to them, the man I spoke to from Kenya, who's now the traffic marshal, he insisted on wearing a mask when I was speaking to him because he didn't want to be in any way identifiable, you know? So people are afraid to speak out. They're aware of how hard the work is and of how dangerous the work is. That young man told me that they were working 12 hours a day during the summertime when it can get as hot as 50 degrees here, and that they just worked. But again, the alternative for him was to go back to Kenya to a life of poverty. So they're aware of that, but I don't think that it's something they reflect on, because how could you get up for work in the morning knowing that this is happening to you every single day? What they tend to concentrate on is what they're going to get, the money that they are going to earn, that they can spend on their lodgings here, their food here. And most of all, what's most important to them is the money that they can send back to their families and their home places and home villages.
Do they watch the matches in their own fan zone?
Yeah, so out in Asia Town, which is about 11 kilometers from where I'm talking to you now, on the edge of the city, there's a huge complex out there where many of them live, 4, 8, 12 people to a room. And at the cricket ground here in Doha, you'll find it on Google Maps, FIFA have set up a huge fan zone there, a sort of a thank you to them. So they tend to get bussed home in the evening from wherever they've been working, if it's a building site or a security site that they've been looking after, a training ground where Switzerland or Denmark are. And then they gather in the evening there around about 6, 7 o'clock in the darkness after sundown. And there's huge screens there and there's cheap food and there's beverages to be had, no alcohol of course, but you'll often have thousands of men sitting there on the grass of the cricket pitch or above in the bleachers. The other day I was there with them when they were watching France play and when England played against Senegal later that evening. But many of them don't stay late because it's an early start in the morning for the migrant workers here in Doha.
Now, we know that Sepp Blatter kind of pulled the rug out from under Infantino when he indicated that he didn't want this tournament to go to Qatar. And then you have Infantino in his rambling address before the tournament talking about, I am a migrant worker, I am da-da-da-da. Most bizarre contribution from him. What is FIFA's attitude? Is it, we're making the best of this and, hey, it's not that bad?
I'll tell you a story. I was out at a press conference for the Danish football team when they were talking about the One Love armband and the difficulty in talking about human rights, especially rights for sexual minorities. And in the middle of that press conference, Pat, the call to prayer at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon was heard. And that for me was the juxtaposition of our Western concepts of human rights and being in a country like Qatar. We have to remember that there's an awful lot of countries around the world, people in Bangladesh and Nepal who are getting sent home money, don't think that this is as bad as we do in the West. That's not to say that it's right, it's just that they don't see it in the same way as we do. And that's the difficulty for FIFA, because Infantino knows, and indeed Blatter was the one who more or less made a system of it. If you have the votes, every vote for every country, it doesn't matter if you're England or if you're Ecuador, every vote carries the same weight when it comes to electing the president. So by having the vast majority of the votes, you get elected. That's how democracy works. Infantino knows that much of the Middle East supports him, much of Asia supports him, much of Africa supports him. And the change, this is the big question that we all have to ask ourselves when it comes to this World Cup. Change, if it is indeed possible, how do we go about affecting that? Can we stand there as Western people and say, this is the way we do things and everybody has to follow suit? Or do we have to meet them where they are and say, look, this is what we think that you could do better? And that's the real difficulty for FIFA. And the increasing difficulty is, if you take the Danes, for instance, all of the Nordic football associations, where I live in Stockholm, so well aware of what they've been doing for the last 7 years, they had a policy of trying to influence things on site. And it worked in part because they managed to get great social democracies that they used to be. They managed to get some concessions for migrant workers, but absolutely nothing for sexual minorities. And I think that was conscious on behalf of FIFA. Maybe it was conscious on behalf of Qatar as well. But whatever concessions they managed to get on behalf of migrant workers, whatever they thought they did, there's still an awful lot of work to do in terms of that dialogue and in bringing the world, the whole footballing world, closer together, as Infantino says he wants to do.
Finally, and it's kind of about Qatar itself, how changed will it have been, besides the infrastructure and the physical aspects of all they did for the World Cup, how changed might they be by the experience of having so many hundreds of thousands of people descend upon them? Will it make any difference at all? And secondly, I mean, is Qatar literally finished? I mean, have they built everything they need to build? Is there nothing left for migrant workers to do?
I think this is very much a long-term strategy. The next thing will be to, host athletics championships, possibly the Olympics, the Asian Games, the Asian Confederations Football Championship. They'll want to hold things like that. The Grand Prix come here into Abu Dhabi. So this is a long-term project in their eyes. But I do think that an awful lot has been learned. There was a huge fear here before, 31 other nations arrived. People did not know what to expect. No more than we have a view of people in the Middle East, they have a view of Europeans and South Americans and Asian football fans as well. They're going to come here, they're going to get drunk, they're going to be grabbing people and fighting in the streets. That hasn't happened here. And I do think that, ultimately it comes down to that meeting between people. Anything that creates a forum where we can meet and where we can talk and we can discuss and that we can see each other's humanity has to be a good thing. How quickly that change happens and how much of that change happens, that's still all to play for.
Philip, thank you very much for joining us. Philip O'Connor, an Irish journalist in Doha at the moment, but based, of course, in Sweden, from where we from time to time communicate. Philip, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.